Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. Thanks so much for being with us this week. With us is Alex Padilla, the United States Senator from California, the senior senator, Democrat, in studio to mark President Trump's first 100 days. Then a conversation about that and a whole lot more with Areva Martin on the left and Jennifer Horn on the right. This week, we have extended conversations with both. Really, really interesting, including a lot of stuff that we weren't able to get onto TV because of just our time restrictions. But the great news about the podcast is I can put it all here and you can hear it all in real time. And this week it is so much better in this format. So I hope you really enjoy this conversations. I certainly did. Let's start with Senator Padilla. We talked about the 100 days. We talked about immigration. We talked about the tariffs. We talked about the Democratic Party, where it's at right now. We talked about Kamala Harris and Gavin Newsom and the fires and recovery, what it's like behind the scenes in the Senate. We talked about his congressional baseball game, all of that in this extended conversation with the senator, one-on-one, in person, exclusive. Here it is.
And welcome to The Issue Is. I'm Alex Michelson, and back with us this week in studio is the senior senator from California, Democrat Alex Padilla. Welcome back to The Issue Is.
Good to be back in person.
Yeah, great to see you here. So this week, it marked 100 days of President Trump. If you had to describe the first 100 days in one word, what would that be?
Oh my gosh, dog years. Can we truncate that into one word? Yeah. No, look, in all seriousness, it's been a painful first 100 days. Yeah. A lot of chaos, like nonstop chaos, just announcement after executive order coming out of the White House, you know, the DOGE cuts, the layoffs. It's just wreaking havoc on a lot of the services and programs and federal agencies that American people rely on. We've seen higher and higher costs, right? For a president who promised to control inflation and bring down prices on day one, the opposite has happened. Mm-hmm. Every piece of rhetoric, every policy, every tariff war that he instigates is making everything go up, the cost of food, the cost of clothing and electronics. I mean, it's nonstop, and it's families that are paying the price literally. And then, of course, the corruption is just egregious. The conflict of interest, whether it's Elon Musk and his efforts, the Trump family themselves. I mean, it's horrible.
So that's all the negative.
That's you know,
all there
the
are
negative,
some people yeah. that see some positives, including on the issue of immigration. That's where he polls the best of all of the issues. We have seen a 95% decrease in illegal border crossings. Is that a good thing?
Well, there's always been two elements of immigration, right? That's how are we handling the people that are seeking to come here for whatever reason? Is it just economic opportunity? Is it seeking asylum because they're fleeing violence? They're fleeing corruption in their home country? There's got to be a better way. We haven't modernized our immigration system in decades. That's long overdue. But separate and apart from that is the treatment of immigrants that have been here in the United States, many cases for years and years, in some cases decades. How does a maybe somebody who's undocumented but has been working, paying taxes, raising a family, has citizen children, and is embedded in our communities and in our economy, just swept up off the streets and deported without due process? I think that's really what's at the core of the problem of this administration and their policies and their actions, their disregard for the rule of law and due process. So even though he polls best on immigration, even then he is underwater.
A lot to unpack in what you just said. So let's take it point by point. In terms of, though, is it good that illegal border crossings are down?
That is good. That, I'm not going to contest that. That is good. And I'll even go one step further. You know, when he was campaigning, saying we're going to see the largest deportation in our country's history focused on violent criminals, nobody disagreed with that. But what we're seeing is not that. When you see otherwise innocent men and women, even legal residents here, people who came to the United States by the rules and enjoyed TPS, temporary protected status. Mm-hmm. A lot of people from Venezuela as just one example. And Donald Trump single-handedly removes those TPS protections and says either you self-deport or we're going to deport you. That is not the way to approach it. When United States citizen children are being deported without due process, that is problematic.
So Do you think that the concept itself of somebody being here without documentation, should that be illegal? Should it be illegal to be in this country without documentation?
Yeah, again, that the laws are already on the books. And part of why I go back to, we need to modernize our immigration system. Look, we rely on immigrants. Our economy relies on immigrants, whether it's hospitality, whether it's construction, whether it's agriculture, you name it. Even in Donald Trump's first administration, in the heat of the COVID pandemic, his administration recognized more than 5 million essential workers that were undocumented workers. We relied on them. So they deserve better. I think the problem is for those who want to come to work or for other lawful reasons, it's simply too hard. And so creates this pressure point for people to find other ways to get here. We have to do better by welcoming people who want to come to work, aligning them with employers who are desperate for workers if we want to grow the economy. But all those conversations have taken a back seat. It's all about how cruel can we be to immigrants now and today, and just this dynamic of people being detained without being fully deported back to their countries in facilities outside the United States. That is unprecedented, yeah. Right? We have ICE facilities in different parts of the country with the appropriate oversight, but when you're holding people at a prison in El Salvador, notorious for human rights violations, and we're paying them to do that, or you're sending them off to Guantanamo, that's a whole nother thing.
So, but you say you support the law. So the concept itself that if you don't have documentation, you are not necessarily entitled to be here. You support that as a concept.
Well, again, with some limited rights. There's a lot of people who are here undocumented and have appropriately sort of registered with the Department of Homeland Security as they've been instructed. They check in with somebody from time to time as they are awaiting sort of their day in courts to make their case. And complying with that. And it is just unconscionable that somebody comes in for their mandated sort of check-in appointment and just snapped up right then and there and saying, you're not going to get a chance anymore. You're out of here.
What do you think due process should look like? Because obviously the Trump administration feels like there's millions of people that are here illegally. We want to get them out as soon as we can, seems to be their approach. And so due process kind of is inconvenient to them because they want to get people out quickly.
Well, in their mind, due process may be inconvenient, but it is the law of the land.
So what do you think what sort of due process are you entitled to if you're here? What does that look like?
And it's something that we fought hard for in the prior 4 years during the Biden administration to add more resources for more immigration judges, more hearing officers, more capacity so that people can have their cases heard and resolved in a matter of weeks and months, not years and years. That's the injustice for everybody here. But again, that's not what Donald Trump is doing. Instead of investing in that capacity to have that day in court, if you will, to make your case, he's not even asking. He's not letting you talk to an attorney. He's just deporting people indiscriminately.
And Trump did not support that bipartisan bill that would have given a lot
more of those judges. No, he called for Republicans to defeat it, and they did so with tail between their legs. And the last thing I got to mention is, look, this ties into the conversation about the economy. We're here in Southern California. You know, we just lived through historic fires, the Eaton Canyon fire, Palisades fire. We're going to have a lot of reconstruction to do. 40% of the construction workforce in California is immigrant, not just undocumented. There's a lot of documented immigrants there too, but clearly under the Trump administration, even if you're a legal resident, documented immigrant, that is not enough to protect you or to keep you from being indiscriminately deported. So there's a reason there's a lot of fear and anxiety out there.
And a lot of the construction materials come from other countries. So let's talk about tariffs. So if immigration is the most popular thing that Trump has done, tariffs is the most unpopular thing that Trump has done. So much so that this week there was a vote in the Senate where there were three different Republicans that joined with the Democrats to try to stop Trump's emergency proclamation, which has allowed for these tariffs to go up against China. What's happening behind the scenes right now on that front when it comes to tariffs? And because you need like one more Republican. So is that almost there?
And it's not the first time that we took a vote on opposing Trump's tariffs moves. A couple of weeks ago, we did and prevailed. We had the fourth Republican to join the 47 Democrats to undo this, at least via the Senate. The House, they continue to give Trump whatever he wants, the Republican majority there. So It came close this time. To think that Vice President Vance had to come away from whatever he was doing to come to the Senate to cast a tie-breaking vote to try to save face for Donald Trump tells you a whole lot about the unpopularity of their agenda, but sadly the willingness for the vast majority of Senate Republicans to just fall in line with Donald Trump when behind closed doors, they know this is problematic. They know this is bad. They know it's raising prices on their constituents just as much as they're raising prices on mine. So I'm still waiting for them to grow the backbone and have the courage to do what's right.
I mean, are they literally saying that to you behind the scenes?
Not every member on every single issue, but yes, it is palpable. Behind closed doors, they know how problematic a lot of the Trump agenda has been, but the political forces being what they are in MAGA world, they're afraid to stand up.
We know California is home to the Port of L.A., the Port of Long Beach, which just on their own are responsible for 40% of the imports into this country. We heard from the leadership there saying that in the next week or so, they're going to be down 35% of their supply, which is going to hit people and make things more expensive. What do people do in the meantime? I mean, as you guys all fight this, what are we looking at in terms of the economy? And is there more that can be done to try to stop this?
Right. So a couple of things. Well, we're going to keep bringing these tariff votes up in the Senate to see if Republicans will come around to do the right thing, number one. And if not, let the public see where you stand on these critical issues. You know, you mentioned the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. You said 40% of imports come through those two ports. So when their business goes down 35%+, what's that going to mean? It's going to mean lower stock on the shelves. It's going to mean higher prices for what you do find on the shelves. Over time, it will mean people losing their jobs because there's just less of that activity. And while it may start here on the West Coast ports, California, Oregon, Washington, it's only a matter of time before you see the same dynamics on the East Coast ports or those in the Gulf. You know, we're sounding the alarm right now because there's still time. If either Republicans in Congress or the president could finally admit and do the right thing, we can avoid this economic catastrophe. So the urgency is absolutely there.
You think he will?
God, I hope so. And even that uncertainty is damaging because we're up on the previous deadline to adopt these tariffs or have them go into effect or not. And then he, because of what was happening in the stock market, right? He saw people's pensions being devastated, not right. just, you know, what was happening with the equity and stock values of his favorite companies. And so they postponed it for 90 days. But at the end of 90 days, then what? Right. Is it, okay, they're going into effect now? Or no, not after all, we changed our mind. Maybe they're going to be double the 25% that he threatened. That uncertainty alone is keeping business owners from investing in their businesses. They should be increasing capacity, hiring more people. The opposite is happening. So the fact that our economy has shrunk in the first quarter of this year is all because of Trump.
You recently visited the fire zone in Pacific Palisades. This week, I spoke with Governor Newsom about that issue, and he actually said what President Trump has done in terms of the fires is something he's happy with. Here's some of what he said.
At the moment, I'm extraordinarily satisfied by that partnership. There's been no politics to date in this space.
Extraordinarily satisfied with the partnership, no politics. At the moment is referring to the fact that they still haven't secured more money for, you know, long-term recovery. First off, do you agree with that? Are you happy with what's happened so far in terms of the Trump administration on this?
Well, I agree. On the fire recovery at the moment, my answer also is yes. I was there just a week ago looking at getting a briefing on the latest when it comes to the cleanup, the debris removal, not just the hazardous material that needed to be addressed. And by all measures, whether it's Army Corps of Engineer work, FEMA work, EPA work, et cetera, they're on time, if not ahead of schedule on some of this work. It's like springtime when trees and flowers begin to bloom again. We saw the first parcel in the Palisades where wood beams were going up as the first home was beginning to rebuild. That is a sign of hope, a sign of life. But we're not out of the woods. We know this is a multi-year process. More aid and funding is going to be required that hasn't been approved by Congress yet. So that's my job, to continue to work on a bipartisan basis to replenish the sources of funding with FEMA, with SBA, with others. But California is not in it alone. There's been disasters in recent months in the Carolinas, other parts of the country. So you have the interest of Republican and Democratic senators, members of Congress, to replenish these disaster aid pots of funding.
Do you feel confident that at the end of the day you will have the bipartisan votes to get California the money that it needs when it comes to the wildfires?
So I do believe we'll have the bipartisan support for the funding, and most importantly, for that funding with no strings attached. This is not a time to play political games or advance unrelated agendas. American families are hurting, and there's both Democrats and Republicans that live in the Palisades, Pasadena, and beyond.
Yeah, and that last point is something that the Republican members from California in the House have agreed with you on, that right. We should not have conditions. Another big thing you have talked about is voting rights. You were the former Secretary of State in California, ran the elections in this state, so this is something you're taking a lead on in the Senate. Republicans are trying to pass something called the SAVE Act, which was essentially put a citizenship requirement to voting, which already is, but a proof of citizenship requirement. Basically, you have to prove that you're a citizen in order to vote. Conceptually, what's wrong with that?
The problem is it's a solution in search of a problem. As you said, it is already the law that immigrants are not allowed to vote. Only United States citizens can vote in elections. And every study, every audit, every report shows that it is extremely, extremely negligible, the number of improper voting and violations going back decades, not just a couple of election cycles. So if it's already working, what does the SAVE Act do? SAVE Act is another sort of immigrant scapegoating measure to impose unnecessary burdens on not just voting, but voter registration to begin with. What would it need to prove citizenship? Birth certificate. I don't know about you. I don't walk around with my birth certificate every day. I don't even know where it is at home. I just know I have it somewhere at home. Half the American public, half the eligible voters don't even have a current valid passport. You know, so you're making it difficult unnecessarily because unlawful voting is extremely, extremely rare. Two examples just to really bring it home. Say a woman who, when she got married, chose to change her last name. All of a sudden, her ID that she presents is her name there is different than what it says on the birth certificate. She has to go through extra hoops at the county to be able to register to vote. You're a citizen. You fought for the right to vote. You have the right to vote. And now it's called into question. Active service duty members, when they get redeployed from one base to another, all of a sudden they have to change their registration. Bases are rarely anywhere close to the county office. And you can't do it online or by mail anyway because the SAVE Act takes those options away. So it's just hurdle after hurdle after hurdle that's not necessary. It will have the effect of preventing eligible United States citizens from registering to vote and casting their ballots.
You think it's going to pass?
I'm going to do everything in my powers to make sure it doesn't pass or that it doesn't even come up in the Senate.
A couple other quick political headlines of the week. Mike Waltz is out as national security advisor. They're moving him over to be UN ambassador. You think that's a good thing?
Well, on the one hand, out as national security, what took so long? You know, this signal gate was weeks and weeks and weeks ago. Trump did not act quickly as he should have. But second, to now appoint him to another important position, ambassador to the UN, when he's already demonstrated a lack of judgment necessary to do a serious job, I think that's very, very problematic. Going back to Signalgate, where's the accountability for Pete Hegseth? He's the one that put classified information and war plans on a commercially available app. His head's got to roll.
So you want him out?
He needs to go.
And in terms of Walls, doesn't sound like you're going to be voting for him for UN ambassador.
So we've already seen the type of judgment he exercises.
No. So that's a no for you. Okay, a couple quick notes in terms of California politics. any favorites in the race for governor?
No. I know them all. And I've worked with all of them. So yeah. Californians have a lot of good options.
Some people have already pre-endorsed Kamala Harris, even though she's not in the race yet. Would you support her if she got in the race?
No. Look, I got to respect that she's taking the time she needs to make whatever decision she makes, and whatever decision she makes, I'll respect.
Okay. What about if Governor Newsom runs for president? Are you supporting him?
Oh, it'd be great to have a California in the White House. Hasn't happened in a long time. We've never had a Democrat.
I know.
California, the White House.
Came close the last time around. But, and then just broadly on that topic of the election and where we're at, would you admit that President Trump's pretty good at branding?
He certainly knows how to sell to a certain group of American people.
So if you think of the Republican brand that he would articulate, I mean, most people would probably be able to say it's make America great again. We want to cut taxes. We want to cut regulations. And we want to crack down on immigration. What is the Democratic brand?
Well, first, let me just, before I talk about Democrats, let's talk about the Republican brand and Donald Trump in particular. What he says may sound good to a lot of people, but they're lies. Mm. You look at what he says, what he's selling, and what he's actually delivering, and he is lying and doing damage to our country. He's not making America great again.
But that is the brand that a lot of people would acknowledge. When they see him, they would say that. What do you think the Democratic brand should be?
Well, I think Democrats have been and will continue to be the party of working people, the party of hope for the future, the party of keeping the American dream alive. And what does that mean? It means access to a good education. That's what my parents, immigrants to the United States, that's all they hope for, that my sister, my brother, and I will get a chance to get a good education. What is the Republican Party doing? They're eliminating the United States Department of Education. You know, to be able to provide for your family, you want to be able to have a good paying job. It's Democrats who have delivered labor rights and have defended the right to organize and help the labor union movement build the middle class in America. What do Republicans do? They want to undo labor unions and labor protections in the workforce. Maybe California-centric, but it's not just California. Our climate crisis is real. It's existential. Democrats take it seriously, thoughtfully. California's policy leadership is ridiculed by Republicans. But what has it translated into? Not just emission reductions, but the fourth largest economy in the world. Mm. What's the Republican Party delivering? Increased costs. A shrinking economy.
Mm-hmm. That's
the contrast is pretty clear.
We'll end with something called personal issues, which you've played before.
I got a lot of them.
Yeah, so do I. The therapy bill is high. Okay, so let's. This is your current cultural favorites. We've done with this with you in the past, but just to get a sense of what you're doing away from the job in the few minutes that you have.
All right,
so what's the favorite TV show you've watched or binged lately?
TV besides The Issue is?
Yeah.
I think now that it's baseball season again, catching a Dodger game every chance I get.
Okay, favorite book you've read lately?
The favorite book I've read, you know, there's a new book, I'm blanking on the name of the author, but it's about Ritchie Valens. I've seen the movie umpteen times.
Yeah.
A new book just came out a couple months ago that has more of the real story, real interviews with a lot of the family and friends of Ritchie. Easy read, but another inspiring one.
Last concert you attended?
The last concert I attended, it's been too long.
Too long. Okay. We want to also highlight the fact that we know your real love is baseball. And so let's show everybody this moment from the congressional baseball game last year.
Uh-oh.
He hit the plate and a ball hit to left field. It's a base hit.
Look at that guy. So this was you. Clearly a star with the bat. You also were a pitcher in this game as well. The Democrats didn't do so great. Republicans kind of won pretty big. But you had big moments. I know you're preparing for this game again. Talk to us about Alex Padilla, the baseball player, and what the preparation is like now.
Not a bad debut. 3-for-3 and a walk, a couple of RBIs. Put us up temporarily in the lead in the second or third inning. I had a lot more fun in the game for charity than I expected to. So planning to play again this year, it means really early mornings in Washington. You know, when you have to be on the field for practice at 6:30, 6:45 a.m. Eastern time and the body's still thinking it's 3:30, 3:45, it's tough, but nothing like playing baseball again to get the day started.
What should we expect from you this year?
Not to hurt myself.
Okay. And just lastly, one of the things we do on our show every week, my mom is so generous in that she bakes cookies for our guests every week. So this is some of the cookies that she makes for all of our guests in this Issue Is box. And after years of getting that, you came with some of the goods yourself.
Absolutely.
Porto's returning the favor to us. So thank you very much.
And only half returning the favor. As I mentioned before we started recording, we love to bake in the Padilla household. Mm. We have my mom's pumpkin bread recipe, which I still owe you.
Okay.
Just been a little busy for baking these days, but we'll be back. And just thank your mom. She's always great for me and the kids.
We went to one of the great bakeries, though, in Porto's represented as well. All right, you outdid yourself with this. Thanks for coming in, Senator.
Thank you.
Appreciate the perspective.
Our thanks to Senator Padilla. And now to our Issue Is panel with Areva Martin on the left, longtime civil rights attorney, one of the guests on our very first show here at The Issue Is, and Jennifer Horn on the right, the host of The Morning Answer on AM 870 in Southern California. It's her first time on The Issue Is, so let's begin there.
Jennifer, welcome to The Issue Is for the very first time.
I know. I'm so happy to be here with you. Thanks for inviting me in.
Yeah, and Areva has been with us literally since week.
Glad to have you here, Jennifer.
Good. I got my training wheels
with
me.
I can welcome you, too.
Literally since week one. And this week is our anniversary. So we've got some video of you from our first show, which was this week, 7 years ago. This week. So that's when The Issue Is first started. So happy anniversary to you, Areva.
Thank you. And it keeps getting better. You've won all kinds of awards and you've gone statewide, I don't know, nationwide, worldwide. Congratulations.
Congratulations. Really well done.
Thank you very much. We appreciate that. All right, let's start the conversation by talking about your friend of many, many years, Kamala Harris, who reemerged at Emerge, this big event in San Francisco this week, her first policy address since President Trump took over. And she really went after President Trump pretty hard. Here's some of that.
What we are in fact witnessing is a high velocity event where a vessel is being used for the swift implementation of an agenda that has been decades in the making.
Sort of talking about this long-term strategy. Interesting what she said, interesting what she didn't say. She didn't talk about California issues really at all, people trying to determine whether she's running for governor or running for president, but the national issues she seemed very passionate about.
Yeah, let's talk about those dance moves a little later, but kudos to my friends for whipping that fan and boots on the ground dance. But yes, some parts of that speech I had seen because she was at Leading Women Define down in Dana Point about a month ago, and I was at that conference, and I had the honor of being at the luncheon when she kind of gave us a preview of that speech. So we know what she's been thinking. We know that these issues are very troubling to her, some of these issues around immigration, issues around DEI. Look, Kamala Harris, at the heart of who she is a lawyer, is a former prosecutor. So to see the rule of law being just trampled over by the Trump administration and by the MAGA right is very personal to her.
Mm-hmm. Your takeaway?
Yeah, I thought it was a much darker speech for her. For the first time out, it was a little bit more, I mean, I know we had the fun with the elephants and people love to talk about that and make jokes, but I definitely thought it was a darker tone for Kamala Harris. And so it kind of got you thinking, and we talked about it on the radio show, what are her plans? What is she looking to do? Clearly, she's looking to be back in the spotlight.
She wants to run for something. That we know.
Right. So is she going to run for governor? Or is she going to run for president? And for me, she's in a tough situation. As someone on the right, when you look at her as a presidential candidate, she's going to have to do a lot of changing from where she was. And there was a poll, I don't know if you both saw it, but CNN had a poll out this week that said, if you chose today, who could run the country better? Trump was at 45% and Kamala was at 43%. So it's tight, but she's still not regaining anybody's support after that big loss. So I think she'd have a lot of work to do to become president, to have a viable run, although she's got that name recognition. But boy, running in California, you have a lot to explain if you're a Democrat, because California is failing. And I think it would be an easier trek for her to become California governor with the Democrat machine, but she's going to have to be ready to address the problems that California is facing. They're real.
What do you think she wants?
I just want to address something Jennifer said about that poll. I hadn't seen it, so thank you for bringing it up. But I think it's very telling that she's at 43% when she's been so quiet. I think if that poll were taken after she'd been out talking publicly, addressing crowds in the way that we saw at that speech, I think there'd be a very different number with respect to that poll. But one thing about the governor of California, obviously she can't go wrong, governor or president. The governor of California is going to be that key Democratic elected official who's going to take on the Trump administration. So I think a lot of people want to see her do that because they know she would be best at prosecuting the case against Donald Trump. But there are also folks who believe that she only had 107 days in that presidential campaign. She raised $1.5 billion. She got 74 million votes. You know, she did exceptionally well in 107 days. So a lot of people feel like there's still work that can be done. And if she had the full length of a real presidential campaign, that she could have beat him then and definitely could be the next president.
Why do you think her poll numbers were better towards the beginning and actually dropped off in the last month? It seemed like the shorter, if it would have been shorter, she would have done better.
Well, I think we can't read too much into, again, 107 days. We don't have a precedent for that. We don't have, data that we can look at, history that we can look at for someone who got thrusted into the position in the way that she did. So everything about that campaign was so unusual. It was, issues of first impression. So I think we have to look at how she is doing now. Again, that poll that you cited, Jennifer, I think is very encouraging. And I'm sure her team is looking at that, saying a lot of people still want me to be the president of the United States.
She is going to have to do some explaining, though, because I do agree that 107 days, she was at a deficit already launching her campaign. Totally will give her that. But I think she's part of the problem. She was part of the administration. She owns a lot of the things that people didn't like about the Biden administration. And I'd also say she's going to have to explain why she was part of the cover-up of Biden's mental state. She was right there with him. And unfortunately, I think a lot of people lost trust with the Democrat Party. They're going to have to rebuild and present a new vision for America instead of trying to clutch on just the anti-Trump message. I think we're going to need to see a vision, and we're going to need to see some acknowledgement that the American people relied to for a long time.
And, that there's going to be a lot more about that in the coming weeks as new books come out on that very topic.
Well, no doubt anyone running for president on the Democratic ticket in 2028 is going to have, I think, a competitive advantage, the likes of which we have not seen, because the first 100 days of this Trump administration has been a complete disaster. Every day, there are groups and groups of voters who voted for Trump, who have voters remorse, who thought this presidency was going to be focused on lowering prices, making everyday life for middle-class Americans better, but yet people go to the grocery stores, they go to furniture stores, they go to buy a bed. Wherever they go, they see higher prices. And you don't see a president focused on lowering prices. You see a president focused on retribution and revenge, going after Harvard University, going after universities, going after government workers. So I think Democrats have a tremendous amount to work with, and the table's being set by Donald Trump.
Would you call it a disaster?
With all due respect, I would call it an amazing success, actually. These first 100 days of Trump, I think, are exactly what he promised his supporters. It's exactly what we were hoping to see. I mean, look at what we've already gotten. We've gotten $5 trillion investment into the country. We've gotten the promise of 440,000 jobs that are coming back into the country. The border is secure for the first time in 4 years, and he did that in about 3 seconds. You've got 26 hostages that have been sent home. You have a real transparency and common sense nature that's back. And I think people are actually appreciating that. We actually can see a functional White House, and it may be fast moving and it may be operating at the speed of Trump, which was a lot of people say. Some people say it's chaotic, but I say he's been actually delivering. My call now is for Congress to actually codify some of these policies that he's put into place so that we can actually really start to feel the effects.
I think, Alec, what you just said, Jennifer, is just epitomizes what's happening in this country. You live in one world. I live in a completely different world.
Look, my mom is liberal, so
I
do
not
these conversations
see all
the time.
Of the success you're talking about. I see the trampling of people's rights. I see people being pulled off the street. I see poor students being terrorized. I see people being fired who have been told on Monday that their job performance is outstanding, and on Tuesday being told they're being laid off because of being fired. I see a man in the name of Elon Musk who was given a carte blanche to do whatever he wanted to do in the government, and lies about what he has done, and lies and lies and lies from this administration. Promises made, promises broken. One of the biggest ones is Project 2025. Trump disavowed Project 2025, tried to distance himself from it. And now substantial number of people who worked on Project 2025 work in the Trump administration. And so many of the policies that we knew would be harmful to this country that were laid out in that policy agenda are now being implemented by this administration. So this administration has lied, distracted, and distorted the truth. And people are feeling it. And a lot of those voters, Jennifer, are saying they have voters' remorse. If they had to do it all over again, they would not
Yeah, I think we have to clear up this Project 2025 thing, because I've heard so much about it and people try to vilify. There is so much fear-mongering going on the left. People are constantly fear-mongering and they literally are scaring people. And so much so that I think people are losing jobs or losing a lot because of all the fear-mongering that's going on the left and sometimes in the mainstream news media. Not here, of course, Alex. But but I will say with Project 2025, that was simply policy papers put together by the Heritage Foundation. It was never President Trump. It was never anything that he wrote. Certainly, those are some of the top conservative thinkers out there, and he's brought some of those people into his administration. But the big bag documents, I mean, I actually read through some of it because I want to be fair, and I want to know what they were vilifying in this. And there was really not a lot out of the scope of what President Trump has run on. And for Elon Musk, by the way, I think he's been vilified. He's been attacked personally, financially, and he's almost cut $1 trillion of waste. I don't know how we stand against cutting waste, fraud, and corruption from a bloated government.
Even Republican congressmen acknowledge that these so-called cuts are in many ways distortions of the truth. He's taking credit for cuts that were made by the Joe Biden administration. He doesn't have the receipts for these so-called cuts. Many of them have not resulted in these savings, but they've resulted in chaos, and they've resulted in the complete devastation of lives of people who worked in the federal government for years. But let me go back to, again, I just want to say real quickly, you know, I have to address autism, near and dear to my heart. JFK.
Thank you for your work with that, by the way.
Oh, thank you, Jennifer. You and I are having too much
fun together.
They're going to be buddies by the end of this.
Yeah. This
political
is good.
We bring people together.
Well,
that's what
this show is, right? It's about, you acknowledge that everybody lives in echo chambers.
And
it's important to bring people around the table, right?
That's right.
And find areas of agreement. But now tell us your area of disagreement.
Robert F. Kennedy, the Health and Human Services Secretary appointed by Donald Trump, has been a complete disaster. His comments about autism, his comments about what people with autism can't do, so offensive, based on junk science, not driven by data or science. And the way they are dismantling the Health and Human Services Department, the complete gutting of our Department of Education, has put the lives of children with autism, their families, adults with autism at risk. All the work that we've done in this community for decades to make autism, people with autism feel accepted and to get them the resources and services they need. We feel in this community with one horrific speech, this man who calls himself our Health and Human Services Secretary has just undermined that work. And it's scary talking about a registry where people with autism have to sign and have all their personal data revealed to the government, undermining the credibility of scientists like those at UCLA and UC Santa Barbara and San Diego. Just all of that work being in jeopardy because this non-science guy believes in quack sciences.
To chime in on RFK Jr., and I hear your passion on this issue, and I think sadly so many of us are distrusting the government. We're distrusting the so-called science. I mean, just you have to look and see what happened to us during COVID. We were locked away. We were told to stand 6 feet away. People died in nursing homes and hospitals all by themselves. People were really isolated, and that was because the government used science to lie to us. And so there is a distrust, and I do want to see RFK go in there and say, you know what, Big Pharma, maybe we have some questions for you. You know what, Big Agriculture? Maybe we've got some questions for you. Why are you all in bed together? Why are you all in ownership with one another? There are questions to be asked. It's okay to do that. We can have these conversations and still celebrate our freedom, especially when it comes to our health.
Real quickly, I appreciate your acknowledgement that there are people with different perspectives and we're bringing people to the table here. In terms of Trump, though, do you think the tariffs are a potential real problem for him?
So I acknowledge, politically. Yes, I acknowledge that I am one of four people on the planet that have no problems with the Trump tariffs. And I'll tell you why. It's been one of my hot button issues for a long time. We are dependent on China. We are dependent on China not just for our clothes and for the stuff we want to buy on Temu or whatever it is, or Amazon. We're not just dependent on that. We're dependent on China for our chips, for a lot of our technology, and more importantly, our pharmaceuticals. And what I don't want to see happen, because we already saw it with the the COVID virus is that China got involved and made people sick, and they didn't do anything to help the situation. They made it worse. The dependence on China is real. It's the biggest threat that we have facing our country. And I'm in for a few months of pain to make sure that we bring jobs back to America, because that is good for us. And we're already seeing it. Mercedes announced investments. We're going to bring jobs back to this country so we can cut that dependence. It is a national security threat.
Okay, so let's go back quickly to the governor's race. On the Republican side, so far we have Steve Hilton and we have Chad Bianco both running. You talk to Republicans every day. I know this weekend you have a big event with both of these guys.
That's right.
Who is sort of the Republican choice, if there is one?
I am just so happy, Alex, that there is two strong Republicans in this race. I have to tell you, it's very frustrating, as you can imagine, being a female Republican in California. And you get a lot, I don't know if you noticed, you get a little hate, but you don't have a lot of great representation. You don't have people out there who are doing strong Republican messaging. And this time around, we actually have two great candidates in the race. I look at both of these guys. You and I were at Steve Hilton's launch event. It was a flawless launch. He's come out with some real solutions to California's problems. Sheriff Chad Bianco talks about helping the middle class by taking away the state income tax. These are all things that will help immediately, where all I've heard from a lot of the Democrat candidates are about the problems of California. But the irony is that in 20 years of California Democrats ruling California, they haven't fixed anything. So we need to see some solutions from them. I would vote for a Democrat for governor if I felt like there was someone who wasn't going to run us into the ground. But
Rick Caruso?
Rick Caruso is a moderate guy. Obviously, if he's up against my friends, Chad Bianco or Steve Hilton, I'm going to vote for one of them. But I think that he might bring some Republicans in if he gets into the governor's race.
So which one is it, Bianco or Hilton?
I'm not ready to make an endorsement yet, but I am supportive of both of them.
You know, Jennifer, you just said that Kamala's speech was dark. Steve Hilton started his campaign talking about California being the sick man of the country.
It is. Talk,
well, no. You can't have it both ways. Democrats aren't painting the state as, you know, this just hellfire and brimstone place. That's what Steve Hilton has done in terms of his campaign. He's a playbook right out of Donald Trump, like make everything look so dark and so dismal and then say, I'm the only person that can fix it. We got a former Fox News host, and then you have this sheriff who has one of the worst records probably ever in the state in terms of police brutality. So when the op research comes out on this sheriff, I think he has like a 0% chance of being the governor of the state. And what the people of California really want, as I said earlier, is someone who's going to take on the Trump administration. They don't want a Trump clone. And both of these candidates on the Republican side are running as Trump clones.
I do not think they have
a snowball's chance in hell of ever becoming the governor
Trump,
of the
though.
State.
But
it
does. We have real
it
no. Trump.
Well,
we have
there are some polls, though, that show that some people are getting sick of just going after Trump and they want more solutions
for
the
action.
State. But to your point, so Kamala Harris, which do you want her to run for?
I want her to run for that race, which she believes where she can be the most effective. And I think she could be an effective governor, but I also think she could be an incredible president of these United States.
Where do you
think
her heart is?
I think her heart is with the people. You know, I'm a lawyer, so.
Her heart's running for president, right?
Her heart is with service. The first thing she did when she landed in California was to go visit fire victims.
Okay. Well, clearly there's a lot to talk about here. Up next, we're going to talk about the current governor of California, Gavin Newsom, and what he was up to this week with regards to Elon Musk. Stay with us.
We're Doge, but better.
And we've been Doge. Some saying that California's use of artificial intelligence is making government more efficient.
We're Doge, but better.
That's Governor Newsom saying that California's use of artificial intelligence is making government more efficient by helping stop fires faster, simplify your taxes, and ease your commute. He admits Elon Musk's chainsaw-wielding Doge has gotten more attention, though.
Are there any lessons to be learned from Elon Musk's theatrics? I mean, in terms of communicating?
The most difficult thing is when you're tearing something down, it's easy to get attention. Easiest thing in the world is tear something down. I could do all that in 10 days. I don't even need 100 days to tear everything down.
But to that question of how do you get along, you and Elon Musk used to get along pretty well back in the day.
Yeah.
How are you getting along now? Have you talked about any of these concepts with him recently?
This is why I need my chainsaw. I haven't talked to him lately. Unsurprising, but a lot of folks that knew him for decades haven't talked to him lately. I've talked to a lot of those folks, comparing notes, and hopefully he comes back around.
Back with our panel right now, Reva Martin and Jennifer Horn. Jennifer, your thoughts on the Governor Newsom, Elon Musk complicated relationship and what it means for us
here in California. I love frenemies. You know, frenemies are always fun to watch. Yeah. But I don't know. I have to tell you, as a Californian, knowing that Gavin Newsom is running for president, every once in a while we start to get lucky because he has to do something kind of sane since he wants to present himself as a moderate. And so, look, I'm not upset with the governor coming out and saying he wants to use AI to fix things. My question is, why didn't you do it 5 years ago?
Well, he says that he did. He says that the Office of Digital Innovation started in 2019.
Have we seen the results, though? I mean, think about it. Under Gavin Newsom, he's got 20% more bureaucrats in California. He's got 41% higher government salaries in California. He's got an insolvent Medicaid system because he's overpromised to illegal immigrants in the state. He's got $30 billion in waste and fraud and unemployment. So if he was really serious about DOGE, and if he was really serious about making those cuts, we wouldn't be sinking and losing money in this homeless industrial complex. We wouldn't be seeing all of these fraudulent things, and maybe we'd actually have a balanced budget.
Yeah, I am on the fence about Governor Newsom as he tries to become the next president of the United States. Obviously, I've not picked a candidate in that race. You know who I would pick if she's in the race. But
yes.
My biggest issue with Newsom is to be in elected office, you got to have a base. And I'm puzzled by who is his base. In this effort to move to the right, to move to the center, who is going to be there to say Gavin Newsom is my guy, is my candidate? And that's what has Democrats so perplexed by so many of the things that he's done, the interviews that he's done with those far right, you know, podcasters, and the way that he's trying to cast himself now as this centrist, I don't know if centrist or, you know, very moderate Democrat. It creates a problem for you because we don't know who he is. We don't know which Gavin Newsom is going to show up on which day. And that could be a real problem when you're trying to run for any elected office. So kudos on the artificial intelligence. I totally disagree with everything Jennifer said about the state of California. Everyone talks about how horrible California is and the scapegoating of immigrants. Let's stop that. Immigrants are such an integral part of our entire country. We couldn't do anything. A day without immigrants would be the sinking of this country. Yeah. So many people in this country are immigrants. So that I just find so offensive on the right, and I just wish they would acknowledge how important immigrants are to the vitality
to
and economic, you know,
we're not anti-immigrant, we're pro-legal immigrant as the Republicans. We are pro-legal immigrant. And by the way, the priority on the Trump administration and with all of the immigration issues is about getting the criminal illegal immigrants out because they are posing a big problem to the safety of American citizens and to the immigrant
That's
community.
That's fear-monging that immigrants are somehow more responsible for crime than American citizens are. We already know that there's evidence and data out there that makes that
claim completely
false.
Taking immigrants who have committed crimes and had due process and been convicted out of the country. Are you for that?
Right? I am in favor of that. But let's go back to that due process, because right. that's getting trampled over. That's being forgotten when you take people off and say, because of the tattoos on your hand, I've unilaterally determined that right. you are a criminal without a due process hearing. So, of course, I would hope that
I don't have an MS-13 tattoo, though. Yeah. Well,
and nor does this construction worker who's been wrongfully yeah. deported. Mm.
So on the Governor Newsom front, it's interesting some of the moves this week. Just this week, the acting director of ICE is actually giving Governor Newsom mm-hmm. credit for working with the department to try to remove people who are here illegally and have been convicted of crimes. He also came out against some of what the Democratic Party is doing in terms of child sex trafficking. There was this big bill this week, a story that got a lot of attention out of Sacramento. We want to show you some video of Maggie Krell. She's on the right here. She's a Democratic Assembly member. She's an expert on child sex trafficking, and she wanted to make it an automatic felony to traffic a 16 or 17-year-old. Progressives pushed back. She was actually removed from her own bill. The bill itself pause. Governor Newsom says he sides with Krell, the Republicans, that this really should be a no-brainer. What's going on here for the Democrats?
Well, first of all, I'm a children's rights advocate, so anything that's going to protect children, I'm there for it. I think the story is being reported out without the nuances and the attention that it needs, because as I've read the story, it's really about, do you treat an 18-year-old kid that solicits sex from a 17-year-old kid in the same way that you would, say, a 50- or 60-year-old man? And I think that's where the Democrats and Krell have been fighting about some of the nuances in the law. I don't think Democrats, and I can say this with certainty, are in any way suggesting that anyone that solicits sex from a minor should not be held accountable, should not face very staunch consequences for that conduct. We have seen just too many instances where powerful men in particular have been able to escape accountability, escape prosecution for their involvement with sex trafficking. So I think it's mischaracterizing the Democratic's position to suggest that they don't want to see anyone involved in exploiting children held accountable.
But you got to admit the politics of this are bad, right?
Well, I think, again, it's the way it's being reported. Yeah. I don't think that the reporting is accurate. I don't think the reporting is thorough. I don't think it's dealing with the nuances as it relates to the law. And there are already very strong laws on the books in the state of California that make it a felony to engage in sex trafficking or to solicit sex from a minor.
We're the only state that doesn't have this already put into law. And it is embarrassing. It's disgusting. Gavin Newsom knows it. Eleni Kounalakis knows it. Christine Pelosi knows it. They all came out and said, what are we doing here, Democrats? And I don't know if it's so much misreporting. I think you have a lot of Democrats in the state assembly who are saying, wait a second, this isn't a great look for us to take the side of people who are soliciting sex from 16 and 17-year-olds. I had Assemblyman Carl DeMaio on my program this morning, and he's a gay Republican. And basically the excuse from the progressive Democrats who are fighting back against this said that somehow it's an equity issue and that it's not fair to black and brown and LGBTQ people. Well, he comes out and says this is using the LGBTQ movement like a window dressing to sell sex trafficking to people. And look, I think it's offensive. It's offensive to those communities to say that it's only those people that are going to be buying sex with 16 and 17-year-old people. I think we have to take a stand. I think any other position is really quite disgusting.
Yeah, no, Jennifer, I don't think they're saying that only black and brown or LGBTQ.
That was a Democrat in the assembly that said that. No,
but I think, again, that is not the position of the majority of Democrats on this bill.
Agreed.
The majority of Democrats are looking at the equity issues when it comes to making laws in this state, you know, harsher laws, more laws, because we know disproportionately African Americans and Latinos are going to bear the brunt of those kinds of laws. So, again, I don't think any Democrat wants to or is in any way suggesting that you should not be held accountable, criminally accountable, for sex trafficking or soliciting sex from a minor. I hope the Democrats and Republicans go back to the table, work this out, come up with a solution that protects children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, really, this is exactly, this shouldn't even be a political issue. I mean, right. There should should be no debate that this is something that should happen. And, you know, Republicans
solved that problem.
Yeah, there we go. Republicans really want to win elections. They'll use an issue like this to do it because it's so common sense.
Let's end with something that I think can bring us together, which is Ariva's great work for the Special Needs Network. You're wearing pink today.
I am.
As a way to promote a big special upcoming event. Put some info on the screen right now. On May 18th, a pink pump affair is happening at the Beverly Hilton. How can people get involved in this?
This is an event, a fundraiser, where we raise money for a free summer camp that we offer every year for kids on the spectrum as well as their typical peers. And this year, we're also raising money for fire victims. So you can go to the SNN website, snnla.org, learn more about the organization, and learn how they can also find some very cute pink outfit to be in the audience as we honor four amazing women who are doing great work in our community and also raise money for kids on the spectrum, as well as, again, those fire victims who've suffered so much. I'd love for Jennifer and Elle, both of you, to be my special guest.
I would love to come. And I love pink, by the way. I have tons of it.
Lipstick on. You look like you look great in pink. We have a great time. We celebrate amazing champions in our community, and we raise money for kids. So something we can all agree on.
I love that. We end on something that brings us all together. Jennifer, great job on week one here.
Thank you.
Nice
happy
to have
anniversary.
You aboard. And OG, thank you. Congrats. Congrats on the big event.
Congratulations to you again.
Our thanks to Jennifer Horn and to Ariva Martin, to Senator Alex Padilla, and to you for listening. Next week, we got a big one. Jamie Dimon is with us, the longtime leader of J.P. Morgan Chase, who almost never does interviews, is going to be joining us in person, in Pacific Palisades, for an exclusive half hour, talking about the rebuild there, talking about the state of the economy, the tariffs, lessons about leadership, lessons about finance, everything. It's really going to be a special, special edition of The Issue Is next week, right here. In the meantime, like, subscribe. Tell people about our show, and please send me a note in social media. I would love to hear from you. Really appreciate it. Thanks for listening. I'm Alex Michelson. See you next week.